Thank you.
So actually, you kind of answered what I was going to say, but I was going to say that when we commonly say the media is publishing certain stories and not publishing certain stories, what we really mean is people are interested in hearing some of the things and not interested in the others. And what can we do to sensitize, for instance, English newspaper readers in India who probably don't care that much about suicides by illiterate farmers about their life?
You know, I respectfully beg to differ with your conclusion that people don't care. One. Two, I would argue, as a journalist in his 25th year, that it has never been an issue of people not being interested. Never. That has never been my experience, or I would have quit the profession long ago. If you look at my book, you'll find that the first chapter, the first preface, is headlined, "Not what the readers want," because that's what 20 editors told me while rejecting my project. It's not what the proprietors want. Don't blame the victim. The victim didn't ask. The reader didn't ask for many of these stories. The reader doesn't have a damn choice if that paper is a monopoly and the only game in town, like the Times of India and Mumbai. One of the things that I found really hilarious, are you familiar with the Hindi language press names of newspapers? Yeah. Before I left India, Dainik Bhaskar ran half a page on Eminem. In the Hindi belt, I only got to know about it because a friend of mine, a Hindi journalist, a very well-informed guy, was asking me, "Ye banda kaun?" You know, a half page on Eminem, the rapper, in a part of the world that has no idea what the heck you're talking about. It has nothing to do with what the readers want. It has to do with what advertisers want, with trying to build a particular kind of culture, with trying to invent a particular kind of reader, and that has been the incredible success of the Times of India. They've invented readership. By the way, it all happened here much earlier than in India. When I first visited this country in 1984, the top gossip columnist, I don't remember her full name, Betty something, had just retired. And she was interviewed by Time magazine. In one sentence, she summed up everything. They asked her, so Betty, she was retiring to do painting at home. Okay, and they asked her, so Betty, why are you quitting? She said, "You guys have taken it away. You've put gossip on the front page. What do I do?" Okay, and I think that just about said it. There was a conscious decision to promote the trivial because of advertising, because of sponsorship, because of the sunny side up need to sell products. That had nothing to do with readers. I would not be standing before you today as a journalist if it were not for readers who kept me alive. When 20 editors turned down the project, which led to Everybody Loves a Good Drought, which is now in its 13th print in 7 languages, because readers don't want it. That project got in because I got a Times of India fellowship in the, you know, memory or image of their beloved founder. And they had, and there was also at that time one of the resident editors who was very interested in such issues. It gave him an excuse to run 3 or 4. They got the largest number of letters they had for any series. And that ran to a series of 84 reports on poverty in the Times of India. The readers did want to hear. No reader wants to hear only those stories. No newspaper has only one kind of reader. And I'm talking about general interest newspapers. And no reader has only one kind of interest. They might want some of the other stories. They might want to read things about. But if you look at the newspapers today, they've abolished the issues that affect 70%. If you look at the beats in newspapers, most Indian newspapers, there's no major Indian newspaper in the English language that has an agriculture correspondent full-time. No major newspaper that has a full-time labor correspondent left. What does it mean? It means that we have taken a decision that 70% of the people don't make news. That wasn't a decision taken by the reader. That was a decision taken by corporations who say that these people don't make news. The top 3% do. The beautiful people make news. When I quit my job and became a freelancer, which I was for 11 and a half years, it was on the decision that I'm going to cover the bottom 5%, you know, as an answer to the coverage of the beautiful people. So I would advise you to revisit this issue. It's about what proprietors want, what corporations want, not about what readers want. Well, you know, personally, I believe that there were many major shifts in Indian politics in the 80s and 90s that were of a positive nature but are now threatened by the kind of changes that have taken place. One, I find, when I look at my 24, 25 years as a journalist, I see an attitudinal change in people from when I went to, say, Chhattisgarh 24 years ago, people spoke to me with extreme servility. Hand across the chest, hand over the mouth, bent over to address you because you wore a pant and a shirt and were obviously somebody very important. Today, when I go to the same places, I see people with their chest sticking out and I see a gigantic story in that change. The ruled are no longer able to rule in the old way. The ruled are no longer willing to be ruled in the old way. The rulers are not able to rule in the old way. There's a challenge to the authority at every point. Second, people are far more conscious of their rights than they were some years ago. They may not be able to enforce them as they would like to, but they are very conscious of them. Third, for me, the huge positive thing, the greatest positive thing in recent times, as I said, was that 600 million poor people went and showed the world what democracy was about. They were lined up against the most powerful array of forces in the country. A government that spent billions of rupees on propaganda promoting a concept called India Shining, ignoring the India that was burning. You know, promoting a slogan called the Feel Good Factor, mass production, which I called the Feel Good Factory. You know, with all the experts telling them to do otherwise, the voter went and did exactly the opposite. That for me itself measures one of the great shifts, that it's a tectonic shift, that we are not going to listen to you. We are going to do what we think is right. That was one. Third, fourth, there has been in the last 20 years an upsurge of the oppressed. Their participation levels in politics is far more. Five, local governance being brought in by constitutional amendments in India called the Panchayati Raj, the village council governance, has brought into governance people who were excluded from any form of participation in the village life, untouchables, Dalits, as we call them, as they call themselves, more accurately. They came and a Dalit woman can be the president of a village now. This was unheard of before 1993, except in two states. Okay. Yet, having all those positive changes, now we have a situation where the Dalit woman might enter parliament, but parliament means very little, because it has ceded its sovereignty to the WTO and agriculture. At the very moment when the excluded are entering the halls of governance, the levers have less and less power, because someone else is making the decision away from the country, outside the economy. So that's one conflict. So it's an ongoing struggle, but there are many positive things, and for me the 2004 elections was absolutely the most positive. Second, all over the world, huge struggles are taking place. Let me give you one example in India just now. If you visit, I visited a district in Kerala. While going to Wayanad, I landed in a state called Tamil Nadu and drove past one district which strangely disoriented me. It took me 20 minutes to figure out why I was so disoriented while traveling in the district of Palakkad. And then I realized this district, for about kilometers and kilometers, there is not a single sign of Coca-Cola or Pepsi. The people have abolished these things in that district. There's a huge struggle going on over water resources, and the next big struggle in the world is going to be about privatization of water, okay? Which is what the corporations are about, because that's the biggest market left until they figure out oxygen, which they're trying in Kyoto, okay? I mean, they made a modest start there. But every day, Coke and Pepsi drain off billions of liters of groundwater from Indian farmers. It's leading to physical fights and conflicts between police supporting Coke and Pepsi and the farmers. In this district of Palakkad, in a place called Plachimeda, Coke has sunk thousands of borewells much deeper than any poor farmer can afford to go, and sucked off their water. In the state of Karnataka next door, neighboring state of Karnataka to Kerala, the state government actually created a project for Coke and Pepsi where they get 5 years of water free. In a state, in a nation which is under severe water stress for farming, for fresh water. Okay? There are now soft drink companies, factories belonging to these guys, which don't put up their nameplate because they're so scared of the public coming along and beating the life out of them. So these fights are going on. People are getting, you know, conscious that they're being robbed, and they are fighting. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you know, I think that's a fairly common story across the world. And I think one of the funniest political cartoons or saddest, which depending on which way you look at it, on the subject that you're talking about, I saw in this country at the height of the Reagan, at the depth of the Reagan recession. When the recession under Reagan was at its worst, I think it was Herblock, okay? I'm not sure. Maybe it was Oliphant, one of these two. They had this absolutely fantastic cartoon. USS economy is sinking. You know, it's just the bow is above the water. And there are two guys hanging on to the bow. Reagan and his press secretary hanging on with one hand and reading with the other. And the press secretary is saying, Mr. President, according to the latest CBS New York Times poll, your popularity ratings have risen 80%. However, the voters have all drowned. So it's pretty much like that, isn't it? People are sometimes persuaded. Over a period of time, I think that fades. But I think the power of corporations to do that here, in this country, is far greater than anywhere else that I have seen. There is healthy skepticism still left in a lot of other parts of the world. And I'm sure here too. But you're up against much more powerful socialization and ideological processes. Okay, that's a very good question. For about 15, 20 days, the media, you know, immediately the media were traumatized. You know, you can't look that stupid and you don't know what to say, nothing. Especially when you have written before the elections that elections are no more about mass rallies and what, you know, going to the people. Elections are now to be fought in the television studios. The television studios were strangely depleted. However, the market crash in Bombay started saying that, you know, there has to be restraint. We have to balance voters with investors. We have to do this. That way they started coming back into the picture. Right now, it's as if May 2004 never happened. And that's also aided by another factor. the party that benefited from the victory, that from the defeat of the ruling, on coming to power, promised, using the farmers' suicides as an issue, using hunger as an issue, has immediately resorted to identical policies of economics, identical economic policies as the old government. This is a process, again, you've seen all over the world, the Social Democrats in Europe, the Congress Party in India, some of the parties in Latin America have ridden to power on popular anger on these issues and then switched. Okay, so now, incidentally, when people destroyed the National Democratic Alliance in the parliament, they also devastated the Congress in the states where the Congress was ruling with the same policies. So people really voted against the policies, not for a party. But the luck of the draw brings the Congress to power. The Congress has some allies or consultants or whatever who are, I mean, cohorts who are against these policies. The media fire is concentrated totally on those allies in the left, saying, these guys are going to ruin the country, they're bringing it down. You know what the demand of the allies of the Congress is? Honor your program. When a party gets elected on one promise and switches, the media call it pragmatic. That's the word worldwide. It's pragmatic. They're doing something pragmatic. And that's a good thing. The media are part of that system, by and large. In India, we have a much richer spectrum in the media than you do here. But even then, we're on the same model. We'll get to where you are. We're in the same model. We're trying very hard to emulate you and stifle diversity. If you look at both India and US, and I consider the United States to be the second most diverse nation I know after my own. If you look at the level of the population of the United States, there's incredible heterogeneity. How many races you have, how many peoples you have, how many people from how many continents, from how many countries in South Asia, Africa, Latin America you have in this country. In the borough of Queens in New York, some 100 to 115 languages are spoken. At the level of the population, you have such incredible heterogeneity. At the level of your media, you have the most amazing homogeneity. That's the point. At the level of people, you have these 115 languages. At the level of media, you have Clear Channel and Jerry Springer and O'Reilly for variety, right? So that homogeneity in the media, which is a corporate homogeneity, is what makes it very difficult to fight this. In India, the levels of monopoly are not so total as yet, though they are fairly advanced compared to 20 years ago. So people still make the media look like monkeys every now and then. But it's an ongoing battle. You cannot take a few in the media did reevaluate their position. They wrote, yeah, maybe we misread this, etc., etc. There was some amount of breast beating for 15, 20 days, and then it's back to business as usual. The TRS. Huh.
Yeah, and the circle, the NRIs are working with to try to change the mindset, even though the government officials promised during this electoral change that they would work towards that. All of a sudden, they've entrenched and gone backwards. So I'm thinking the inertia, you know, there's a political change. The inertia is quite often really stymied the whole movement. And what kind of critical mass do you need to make it, what that happen?
See, those are very, very, very large issues. But if you look at, say, if you look at the TDP, you look at the Telangana Rashtra Samiti, the TRS, these guys, there are lots of things that are very interesting. And it also connects up in some ways with the kind of socialization process and media monopoly stuff that he's raising. Whether it's the NRI promotion of what was happening in my home state of Andhra Pradesh as this incredible thing. It was also a Western projection of what was happening in Andhra Pradesh to some extent. Andhra Pradesh, the Telangana region, and many of these regions symbolize some of the basic failures of the Indian state in the last 40, 50 years. We've not addressed certain pressing land issues. We've not solved them. Telangana did have a radical land reform, land distribution, after which the movement of Telangana, as you know very well, was crushed physically. So there is a tradition there which knows better, which wants better. But we are not willing to address land issues. 85% of the Indian poor, who are the Indian poor? 40% of the Indian poor are landless agricultural laborers. 45% are small and marginal farmers earning an acre or less. 7.5% are rural artisans, your potters, weavers. And all the other groups, including the urban poor, make up the remaining 7.5%. What does it tell you? It tells you that 85% of the poor, their problem is directly related to land. It's the one issue that no central government in the last 15 years has had anywhere within a mile of its agenda. The same applies to Bihar. This is where the maximum amount of land-related violence is emerging, because these issues are stubbornly resisted. That's one thing. The second is that on such a base, with such kinds of problems as Andhra had, you had to build a fake model where the worse the situation was, the greater the achievements were touted. How many people know that in this tiger economy, when Mr. Naidu ran Andhra Pradesh, how do you know, how many people knew that Andhra Pradesh had the lowest GDP growth in the south of India? In his 9 years, the lowest GDP growth of any southern state was Andhra Pradesh. It was lower than the national average, lower than Andhra itself between 1981 and 91. Its rank amongst the states fell from number 4 to number 8. In the National Family Health Surveys, one was held in 91, one in 97, 98. The only southern state that did not show improvement in infant mortality rates in the south was Andhra Pradesh. Its educational performance is the worst in the south. The literacy rate of Cyberabad, the great miracle software capital, is lower than that of Patna in Bihar. Okay, but it was a Goebbelsian thing. If you shouted the lie often enough and loudly enough, it worked. It worked for those for whom it was meant to work. Unfortunately, it did not work at the level of the population who knew and know that their basic concerns were not addressed. And I want to show you that in the Telangana region, when the defeat came for the TDP, in Cyberabad, their centerpiece for the entire universe, out of 15 seats, they lost all but two. Even in the place where they should have had the maximum success, they were wiped out. So there's this huge gap between mass media, mass reality, between what the elites are addressing and the issues that people are raising. Where is this?
Telemark. It's the Oregon
coast. Okay, sorry.
It's a dairy farm association that has the second largest, what they call chunk cheese distribution in the country. And they don't want to use goat line to grow Telemark because their customers say they don't want to use cheese. And Monsanto is saying they have to buy. And they're going to put more pressure on these farmers to use it. How do you get that story out?
Thing is, they're using it now. They want to stop using it.
Well, they're using one of them. They're trying to enforce a second one on them.
If it has already entered the production chain, it's going to be very, very, very difficult. One of the things with the whole experimentation and what Monsanto and others did in India, for instance, will give you an idea. We had, after the Green Revolution, a seed certification regime, which meant that seeds... When you put a packet of seeds on the market, you had to guarantee that 90%, 85 to 90% would germinate, because no packet can have 100% germination rate. This didn't suit Monsanto and the other big companies that were entering India in the 90s. They negotiated with the same Andhra Pradesh government and introduced memoranda of understanding, bypassing farmers, bypassing farm unions, bypassing, seed experts, everything, and put out an MOU where the seed this guaranteed germination rate was reduced to 60%. So today, If you buy 1,000 bags of seed, you pay for 1,000 bags, but you get 600 bags. I didn't know about this. It had happened so silently. I'm a journalist who covers that place. It was brought to my notice by farmers in a village who said, who told me, suppose you went to a pharmacy, to a medical shop, and you were offered a medicine which says 60% of this might work. Would you buy it? I said, no, I wouldn't. And why would you? They said, we have no choice. Because they've let loose all these seeds in our market, and every one of them is now, they've lowered the bar. Even our local manufacturers have lowered the bar. Then, to be able to lower the bar, they removed every kind of regulatory mechanism that existed. You know what happened? Not only did BT and not only did BT cotton and other stuff came in, thousands of spurious seeds came in, spurring further suicides. That you cannot trace it, you cannot pin it down because the regulatory process is gone. Once it entered the production chain, it had devastating effects, and it's very difficult to separate and say this is from here, this is from here. The same is now, I mentioned, pepper is collapsing in Kerala because of the import of cheap pepper. The cheap pepper has not only entered the market, it's entered the production chain. When it's entered the production chain, it's causing pest. Now it's going to take very experienced scientists years to figure out how the hell to fix what has gone wrong. Okay, so it's not easy, it's a very tough job. How do you do it journalistically in your, I think it's even more difficult in your circumstances than in mine. But believe me, to get those suicides onto the agenda, it took 5 years to really make people realize that it was going on. The largest Indian weekly, India Today, poured scorn on the issue of farmer suicides. You cannot find a story on it in the period when they were happening with great intensity. You cannot find a serious story in the largest weekly. But you can work out tactics if your farmers are united and if your public can be mobilized behind them. Then you have options of how to draw attention to it. The farmers of Andhra Pradesh are now dealing to some extent with spurious seeds by direct action. Okay? And I see no escape for them. They have to do it. What are they doing? When they got spurious seeds, they captured the seed guy who had put 70 million rupees worth of spurious seeds on the market. The government took strong action against him. But the laws are so watered down that the court censured the government and let the guy go with a $10 fine, 500 rupee fine, for putting 70 million rupees worth of spurious seeds into the market. Next time the farmers didn't go to the court, they captured the seed factory and said, you know, what, do we get compensation or do we get a bonfire? The company paid up. Okay. I'm saying direct action is, there's no option. All over the world, people are resorting, like the people fighting Coca-Cola over there. They're going to take direct action. It has to be collective action organized in the democratic process of those societies as allowed. So I think that you cannot do it just journalistically. You cannot do it through one great article. I don't believe that the farmers' suicides issue was made a gigantic, though people wrongly credit me with it. I think that was made an issue by the farmers of Andhra Pradesh, by their ceaseless, relentless struggle. And the fact that the public felt very badly about what was happening. You know, people are not intrinsically anti-farmer, not at all. There is a nostalgic thing for every one of us came from a village once. There is, in fact, a nostalgic affection for the farming community, except that your farming community is corporate. Largely. So yes, if you can, that action is not going to, journalistically, if you can do something, that's good, but it won't be enough. It has to happen at the level of popular action and direct action as well. Yeah.
I have a form here I got at a subversive group, the Vancouver Peace Coalition. It's a postcard addressed, "Stop Stealing Water," by the Corporate Accountability International.
I don't know currently.
Consumer of Coca-Cola products, I am deeply concerned to learn that your bottling factories in India are draining water, etc. The United States estimates that 2/3 of the world's population not have enough water by 2025. Unless something is done, Coke should stop stealing water from local communities, begin by addressing the demands of affected Indian communities, never reopen your
Plachimada.
Close your plant in Lindigang and pay for the damage done to affected
I have no idea about the group you're talking about, but the facts contained in it are broadly correct. And I mean, I don't know whether what kind of action your local groups choose to take, I'm not aware of. I know the action that it's taken on the ground, and I'm very supportive of it. See, I should tell you one thing, that water theft that they're speaking about, it's costing human lives. And incidentally, if you look at the Indian politics and the Indian polity, every major political crisis in India has had water involved in it. In the south of India, the biggest political explosion is between Tamil Nadu and Karnataka over Kaveri waters. The biggest dispute between the next two southern states, Karnataka and Andhra Pradesh, is over the Almati waters. The biggest dispute within Andhra Pradesh is over the Krishna Waters Tribunal Award for Mehboob Nagar and other districts. The biggest dispute in the north, which led to an explosion in the 80s, was over the Ravi Bees sharing dispute, which was at the basis of the Punjab problem in the 80s and 90s. Our single biggest dispute with our neighbor Bangladesh is over the Faraka Barrage water sharing. Our single biggest dispute with our neighbor Nepal is over the Kosi Barrage water sharing. Water is a gigantic and explosive issue. It's tearing communities apart. In that situation, the luxury of taking it away for amusement parks, water parks, golf courses, soft drinks factories is simply unaffordable. In a desert state called Rajasthan in India, they have a plan of putting a large number of golf courses as part of tourism. The average golf course in the West takes between 1.8 million and 2.3 million liters of water per day in season. If you cater the whole season, 20 villages in Rajasthan can see the entire summer through on that amount of water. People are dying without that water. In Rajasthan, over water disputes and farming disputes, four farmers were shot dead 2-3 months ago by the police in one of these struggles. This is going to intensify and intensify, and we are going to decide in the Nero's guest syndrome whether soft drinks are more important than human lives. We have to take that decision. And I'm saying that farming is being destroyed. If you're a small farmer, and I'm a big company, and I come and put much deeper bore wells, much more bore wells than you can ever afford, you're dead no matter how good, how skilled a farmer you are. And that's what's happening, and that's Plachimala, that's absolutely correct. That's why there's a huge struggle there. Now, I'm not aware of the group that you've mentioned, but I'm pleased that someone's talking about it. I'm really pleased and grateful to that extent, because the facts reflected in that are correct and honest. Yeah.
Which was basically severely distorting the natural process of breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
There has been some success in that campaign, and they've been involved in several other campaigns as well. This is one action right now that has not risen to the level of a boycott yet, but they are trying to put pressure on Coke, and the more of those cards, I mean, I know sometimes you think that elites are just completely oblivious and completely impervious to, you know, popular action, but the more of those cards they receive, I believe, the more, you know, practical pressure will be put upon them. If that doesn't work, then, you know, we can rise to the level of boycotting and possibly even direct action. But as you have so eloquently pointed out, there's been a major mobilization already taking place in India for the last few years. And it's really a severe, serious problem. And, you know, they need, you know, really solidarity from people in this country as well. So
Let me offer you a personal example and confession. Till 2001, I was a very big consumer of colas, and I love them. Okay? But I used to drink an Indian soft drink called Thumbs Up, which since has been bought out by Coca-Cola, leaving me with no options, and therefore I am relatively sugar-free in recent years. However, the reason I gave it up was because of Andhra Pradesh and a district called Anantapur, where the maximum number of farmers' suicides have taken place. I was drinking, I'm a big cola consumer till 2001. I went to an area called Nallamada in Anantapur. It's a place where you used to get, within Anantapur's bad situation, you used to get good, decent, very sweet-tasting groundwater in Nallamada. In 2001, when I was looking in the suicides of Nallamada, people were very reluctant to offer me water. And I said, no, I want water. Give me water because I'm thirsty. And they very shamefacedly gave me a glass of water, which was almost, not almost, it was brown in color and had sediment floating on the top. And then one of the farmers very apologetically told me, see, we didn't want to give you this water, but tell me, sir, why don't you take a Coca-Cola that we have? It was their water that went into that Coca-Cola. From that day, I stopped drinking Coca-Cola. I mean, it was not possible. I still like cola, but I find it's not possible to think about that when that was a life and death situation that I'm trying to talk about. Yeah. Yes.
Over the years. Have there been elements or strategies that they've adopted that you've seen have been helpful in terms of their successes?
You know, apart from the movements that have succeeded, I would say that even the movements that we may not count as successes have left some legacy which works, some tactics that work, some issues that remain with us. So I'm never going to write off all of them as total failures because they teach us something even as they fail. Yeah. I personally think the challenge and the huge trick is in marrying the different energies now loose in the global and national arena. You can no longer say, think globally, act locally. You've got to think globally, you've got to think locally, you've got to act locally, you've got to act globally. The whole plate is on your table now, right? You can't evade. But there are so many specific issues floating about, and this is what I wonder when I look at the WSF and say, maybe we need to think a little further. How do we get these energies together? Speaking of positives, I mean, I think that the elections in Venezuela were a great positive. With the entire might of the United States and all the corporations of the world ranged against Venezuela, the people from the poor hutments and slums and chawls went out and put back in power not once but twice or thrice the government that they wanted. So I think that in some countries that failed. Yeah, but people didn't necessarily stop trying. So I think that how do we marry these energies of these different movements together? If you're going to have transnational oppression, then you've got to have transnational resistance as well. There have been examples of some things like that happening when the first Bush War, what was the third Gulf War and the first Bush War, was fought. There was coordination which just came about between Australian longshoremen and Indian sailors in Calcutta. Okay? About not offloading anything meant for war. They would do everything else but not touch weaponry, not touch anything that they felt was, feeding into the war effort. So I think you're going to have to look at how people can coordinate across boundaries, across continents to make these movements. But I think also it is wrong to start acting as if globalization is something in itself the source of all the problems, and that if we adjust or fix neoliberal globalism, the other problems of... There's something called capitalism too. And there used to be a word called imperialism. A lot of people have forgotten it. And there are words like exploitation which no longer appear in the newspapers. Those issues too you can't run away from. You've got to face those too. You've got to face those nationally, locally, issues of resource control, concentration, monopolies, local and national. Right? Even what we are fighting at is the large rubric which has, encompassed all these issues. But it's not the only one. So I think, how do we work out how do we work out strategies that marry all the progressive energies into major movements rather than just be an anti-Coca-Cola movement or just an anti-Pepsi movement? These are very important. How do you integrate them into other movements that are also, or link them to other movements that are also very important? That's one. Second, how do we balance this national and global? You know, the land monopolies of India were an issue before neoliberal globalization. They've become a much worse issue under neoliberal globalization. It's made things much worse, but they have other roots as well. So how do we differentiate between these, the layered nuances of these crises, and work with them? I think it'll happen. I think that the way people have shown support for the Plachimada struggle from all over the world is one example. So, yeah, and though it's 20 years late, even today groups all over the world are taking up Union Carbide and Bhopal. So some sort of wider consciousness is coming. I won't say that all those movements have failed. I'd say there were elements that we can take from what happened and learn. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sure.